have to go to a funeral like every year to bury somebody, it was hard. I mean, it was hard for me. I got tired of going to funerals.
My husband, his cousins, multiple people. I mean, we're like at, I think, 14.
In Ryan Chappell's family, for generations, there was this understanding. You lived to your 30s or 40s, you got diagnosed with pancreatic cancer, and shortly thereafter, you died. That's just the way it was. Until Ryan's father, and after that, one of Ryan's uncles, one day said, enough.
A patient came to my clinic, a young man. He was in his late 30s, I think, and he said, I'm really concerned I'm going to get pancreatic cancer.
And they went to UW Medicine to try and figure out why this was happening.
This is the UW Medicine Pulse with Marty Reamer. Real-world stories of the discoveries being made at UW Medicine and the impact they're having on people here in the Pacific Northwest and around the world.
Former President Jimmy Carter says he will undergo treatment for cancer. The 90-year-old made the announcement.
When former President Jimmy Carter told the world in mid-August of this year that he had cancer, even before it was revealed what type of cancer it was, much of the media and the public suspected the pancreas.
Mr. Carter has a strong family history of pancreatic cancer. His three siblings and father died from it. People who have three or more close relatives with pancreatic cancer have a 57 times increased risk of having it themselves.
Having the specter of pancreatic cancer hanging over your head is something Ryan Chappell knows all too well.
My dad died when I was 7, and shortly after that, I was kind of given the news like, hey, we need to watch this because you might end up, you know, when you're a little kid and you're told the thing that just killed your hero is going to kill you, maybe. I was really hard, and every doctor was like, oh, well, you don't need to worry about it right now. And they just kind of put it off. And then when I was 10, I finally went and met Dr. Britnall, and she was the first doctor who looked at me and talked to me like I wasn't a little kid, like talked to me like I was a person, and she looked at me right in the eye, and I'll remember she told me two things before I left the thing. She said, I'm going to make you two promises right now. One, I'm going to figure out why this is happening to you and why this has happened to your family. And second, I'm not going to let you die.
The doctor who had that heart-to-heart with 10-year-old Ryan was UW Medicine's Terry Britnall.
Okay. My name is Terry Britnall. And I'm a professor of medicine in the Division of Gastroenterology, and I'm also an adjunct professor of pathology.
Up until my dad decided to come to the university to start figuring this out, it was, you get sick, you die. That's just what happened in my family. Nobody questioned it. Nobody thought about it. You just, if you live past 60, great. Yeah, awesome. You live to be 63. That's amazing. My dad, one day, just, you know, he kind of decides, you know, I'm not gonna let that happen anymore. I'm gonna figure something out because I don't understand. I'm tired of watching my family die.
A patient came to my clinic, a young man. He was in his late 30s, I think, and he said, I'm really concerned I'm gonna get pancreatic cancer. And I was like, you look great. I don't know why you would be worried.
Ryan's dad, David, died from pancreatic cancer before he'd even had a chance to meet Dr. Britnall. It was another Chappell family member who showed up that day in her office. He, like David before him, and like the rest of the Chappell family, though, knew the writing was on the wall.
And then he told me that his father had pancreatic cancer, and four of his uncles, and many of his cousins, and his grandfather. And once I heard that history, I thought, wow, you really could be in trouble here. And so I took a history to find out, didn't any of these people see a doctor? And they had. And I said, well, did any of these people get a CAT scan, kind of a standard method of looking at the pancreas? And it turned out they had. And it turned out these CAT scans didn't give any information about the cancer forming.
And so in an effort to try and help this young man, she began to wonder,
how would we try and track early cancer in people that are susceptible to it? And my first clue from talking to him was, don't do a CAT scan, because that didn't help. So we tried every test that could be done on the pancreas in the beginning, and we eventually came up with methods that help us identify when the pancreas is getting abnormal.
And that was a big deal, Because if you detected the cancer early enough, before the cancer had had a chance to spread, and pancreatic cancer has a wicked tendency to do just that, you still had a chance to intervene, to do something about it.
Ultimately, for me to come up with a diagnosis of precancer, I have to get a piece of tissue of the pancreas and look at it under the microscope. But the idea of trying to use imaging methods to discover when is the pancreas abnormal in these susceptible patients, that was a relatively new idea 20 years ago.
In 1996, Brentinol and her colleague started a pancreatic cancer surveillance program on these high-risk families that she's still co-director of today. The idea then and now was to offer to check these high-risk families on a regular basis for any sort of abnormalities in the pancreas, anything that might be considered precancerous. And if she found something? Well, according to Dr. Brentinol, opinions are split on what to do next.
The management of such patients is very controversial. And so there's no right answer. Some people would say you should just follow them and wait and see if a mass forms and wait till they get cancer and then try to operate. And other people say, well, you know, pancreatic cancer is very hard to cure. So when they get to the stage where they're right before the level of getting cancer, perhaps we should have a conversation about removing the pancreas.
The pancreas has two really important jobs. One is that it regulates your blood sugar, both up and down. So without a pancreas, you become a diabetic.
In addition to that, the pancreas is in charge of making the enzymes that help you digest your food. So we can supply those enzymes for you to eat when you eat your food. So that's fixable. But the diabetes is going to be a long-term, lifelong issue if you have your entire pancreas out.
By the time Ryan Chappell was 20, he'd been part of the surveillance program off and on for 10 years.
I got diagnosed when I was about 7 or 8 with diabetes. I basically kind of got to a point where I didn't want to get checked anymore. I mean, by the time I was like 13, I've probably had my blood drawn more times than most people have in their entire life. When I was 19, I got in a really bad car accident, and I was like, you know what, maybe this is my wake-up call to go back. Right before I was 20, she checked me, and she's like, something looks weird. I want to do this other test to see. That was in June of 2005, and when I came out of the procedure and woke up, she said, I've already scheduled your surgery. You have to have it. 2 weeks later, she took it out, and when they did the biopsy and did everything in my pancreas, I had a tumor in my pancreas. So basically, if all the stuff she hadn't done, I mean, I would have been dead 10 years ago.
As they do the degrees of cancer, so Ryan was at 2. So, you know, it was growing, hadn't gone out of his pancreas, you know, so she was able to catch it because she was screening him, you know. And yes, if you get your pancreas out, you have to be a diabetic, but I think that's worth it over dying.
Remember at that first meeting when Ryan was only 7 years old, Dr. Brentinol made two promises. She was not going to let him die from pancreatic cancer, and
I'm going to figure out why this is happening to you and why this has happened to your family.
Well, to deliver on that second promise, Dr. Brentinol began to
research the gene that might be causing the disease in their family. And we did discover the gene in this particular family, and it's a gene called Paladin.
According to Dr. Brentinol, this mutation in the Paladin gene that was responsible for all this cancer in the Chappell family was pretty unique to the Chappells. Most pancreatic cancer does not show that same mutation. However, even in those cases, Brentinol discovered, Paladin plays a very important role in how the cancer spreads. And the tendency of pancreatic cancer to spread is one of the main reasons why it's such a lethal disease.
One of the things we said is, what would happen if you can make the Paladin go away? Will it decrease the spread of the disease and decrease the ability of the cancer cells to metastasize? And so we have been doing experiments. We haven't published it yet, but it does look like in mouse studies that actually is true. Mm-hmm. The other thing that we're doing with the Paladin is, because it turns out that Paladin is overexpressed, or there's too much Paladin in the fibroblasts in pancreatic cancer, so we thought, is it possible to use that information to come up with better methods for diagnostics?
In the 20 years since she's been doing this work, in the 20 years since she and her colleagues at UW Medicine established the Pancreatic Cancer Surveillance Program, Brentanol has made two significant discoveries.
I would say the first dent for me was coming up with a surveillance program where we could eventually identify pancreatic precancer and come up with a management plan for that. And then the second dent was this discovery of palladin and the importance that it plays in pancreatic cancer formation, and the idea that that protein could be exploited for maybe imaging or potentially exploited in a therapy in the future.
But lately, her work has been hamstrung by another frustrating obstacle.
The pace at which all of this work gets done is directly related to the funding. Pancreatic cancer is one of the most unfunded cancers in the world in terms of funding dollars. It's the fourth most common cause of cancer death, and by 2020, it'll probably be the second most common cause of cancer death. And it has a tiny, tiny fraction of the funding of all the other cancers. Tiny, tiny fraction.
Ryan has been living without a pancreas for a little over 10 years now. And according to his mom, Lori, it's been a tough go.
The depression side of diabetes in general is really debilitating to people. And I don't think people put those two things together. But then when you triple this on with all the other issues of not having a pancreas and all the things that go with it and kidney failure and everything else, it's a burden that you just don't understand because you're not carrying it. And Ryan was always really smart in high school and college. He got lots of scholarships. He was going to be a history teacher. And this roadblocked him.
You know, I wish pancreas cancer was like breast cancer. You remove the breast and you're all done. And the sequelae from that, you know, you could have scar tissue or reconstruction or whatever the issues are. But in general, your life is the same in general. You remove the pancreas and your life is not the same. You know, these issues of diabetes, these issues of low blood sugar, these issues of pancreatic enzymes, these are hard trade-offs, and which is why it's so hard to know what the right thing to do is.
One option for Ryan moving forward is to receive a pancreatic transplant. And while donor organs in general are in short supply, it's even worse when it comes to the pancreas.
Getting a transplantation of a pancreas these days is quite a challenge. People tend to not donate their organs after they die, and a pancreas is a particularly useful organ. There's a lot of diabetics out there that could use a pancreas transplant, so it's a high-demand, low-supply organ. And it can also get challenging for insurance companies to cover it.
I'm kind of a weird kid. I love to read. I'm a really big history buff. Like, that's my thing. I could read history books all day long. I love science fiction, fantasy. I'm a comic book nerd. I like music. Hopefully, once I get this taken care of and all this stuff is done, I like to restart my life over. I see my transplant as like a brand new start date, like I'm being born again. You know, I never finished college, which I'm always been kind of bummed about, and I've had to put it on hold because it's hard to go to school and be sick all the time. So I feel like once I get the transplant, you know, it'll give me that clean slate to go back to school. And even if I don't ever do anything with a degree, I just want to be one of those people who can look back and say, you know what, I finished, I did it.
Successful medical research. It takes ingenious and caring practitioners. It takes funding. It takes some luck, certainly. And then, let's not forget, it takes some very courageous patients.
I feel like we're doing this not only to save Ryan, but in his dad's honor. That's really the bottom line, because David was very giving. He was a fire chief, an EMT. He saved people's lives all the time. So how fitting that he would say one day, you know, he was sick, But it was like, let's not go to just a regular doctor like everybody goes to. Let's find the people that we need to. And that's how we got to the U. I know it would kill him that Ryan has the same thing as him, but I also think he would be proud that he's played a part to for this research.
I want to thank Ryan and Lori Chapel, as well as Dr. Terry Brentnall, for allowing us an insight into their lives and their work. To find out more about the research Dr. Brentnall does at UW Medicine and how you can help fund it, visit our website, uwmedicine.org/pulse. Also, while you're there, you can subscribe to our podcast so you get every episode delivered to your phone or your tablet for free as soon as they are released. UW Medicine Pulse is produced by Tina Knoll, associate producer Aaron Gervais. I'm Marty Reamer. Thanks for listening.